Hey everyone, welcome to the Sketchnote Army podcast. I'm Mike Rohde, your host and the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook. And with me on this show, on this episode of the show, I have none other than Christina Woodke. Christina, welcome to the show.
Hi Mike, how is it going?
I'm going great. Thank you for being on the show. I'm so excited to have you on for a variety of reasons that we'll discover as we talk. Why don't we start off with telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, that's a little complicated. I do a lot of different things. So one of the things I do is I teach at California College of the Arts, where I teach undergrads in the Interaction Design Department. And I also teach at Stanford in the Continuing Education Department. I like to say I teach business to designers and design to business people and teach everybody to draw along the way. I also am an author. I finished up Radical Focus, which is my last book, and I'm working on a new book that I'm very grateful. I got help titling from Dan Rome and Kate Rutter, which is called Pencil Me In, and it should be out in about a month. And I also give talks and workshops and teach people how to work with pictures and stories.
Wow, excellent. Can you talk a little bit more about the book that you have released and the one that's coming? I'd love to put those in the show notes for people that are always looking for another book to help them.
Oh, absolutely. So Radical Focus is actually a book about a technique that's become really popular in the Silicon Valley called OKRs, Objectives and Key Results. And it's a way of setting goals and making sure you actually achieve them, because as we know, life is full of shiny objects that distract us. And when I decided to write it, I was worried nobody would read it because business books are boring. So I wrote it in the form of a fiction. So it's a story of a small startup that's trying to be successful. And at the very last minute, and I know you'll appreciate this, I self-published and I decided I wanted to put my drawings in it. I'd done all these drawings for my talks, and I know business books don't have drawings, but I think Alex Osterwalder would disagree. And so a lot of my sketches are in there. And then the new book happened last semester because of a scheduling error. One of my classes was canceled. And a friend said, why don't you take those 6 hours back and do something you really love? And I'd been teaching my students how to draw for a while. And they would always ask me, is there a book on this kind of drawing? And, you know, I could point them at your book, Sketchnote Handbook, and I could point them at Ed Emberle's Make a World. But I felt like we needed something really simple to get people, you know, unafraid of drawing. So I've been working on that book.
And that's Pencil Me In. Is that the title?
That's going to be the new title. Excellent. I think Dan will find out. He's been arguing I should change it, so he'll find out when he listens to this, this podcast.
They're going to think it's all about scheduling or something, right? And are you going to self-publish this one as well, or is this going to be through a publisher?
I think I'm going to self-publish. To be honest, I like doing unusual things, and sometimes publishers want you to do things very traditionally.
Yes.
So I kind of like the freedom of being able to do things my way.
Well, that's good. I know I was really fortunate to have Peach Pit as my partner on the two books that I did, and they were super flexible and open. A lot of it to do with Nikki McDonald, who I did an interview with a couple of seasons ago, because she was just so crazy and wanted to try some interesting things. So that ended up working really well, but it was definitely not a traditional path. And had I gone with a more traditional publisher, I doubt that the handbook or the workbook would have turned out even as they did. It would have been pretty crimped down and tough to express. So excellent. So let's get a little bit into, you've told me a story, and I think this is really appropriate for the podcast, related to sketchnoting and your students at the California College of the Arts. So why don't I just open it up for you to go ahead and talk about that story with us?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. So when I first started teaching at CCA, California College of the Arts, I was told that the students will not do the reading. And I thought, oh, come on, they're college students. Of course they'll do the reading. And I taught the first class, and I tried to start discussions, and I discovered maybe one person had done it, and it just drove me insane. I was so annoyed. So I told them they had to do sketch notes of all the reading. However, there was so much reading, like it was a long chapter, that I told them, just find big ideas, do a drawing of it. I'm not going to grade you on the quality of the drawing. I just need to be able to tell you that you actually did the reading. And I just had dinner with a former student, and he said, as soon as he realized you really weren't going to grade us on the quality of the drawing, we didn't mind doing it at all. In fact, it helped. And the interesting thing for me about having them do sketch notes, I mean, of course, I could now tell if they did the reading or not, but it changed them. They actually had a deeper comprehension of the reading, and they had higher retention of the reading. Like something I had them read at the very beginning of the semester, they literally would still remember it, understand the concept, and be able to use it at the very end of the semester if they'd done the sketch notes. And it kind of blew me away. And some of these drawings were just ridiculous, like stick figures, no composition, very, very simple, nothing you'd show off to brag, but it still changed them. And that's when I realized that there's something very profound about sketching ideas. The other thing that happens is when they're doing the reading, they have to make sense of it. They have to choose what to draw, figure out what's important, figure out the relationship of the figures. So they were thinking critically about the reading the whole time. And finally, their drawing got better. Even when they weren't drawing, if you draw all semester, your drawing gets better, period. So I found it a very transformative practice with my students. And the other thing that happened is the other teachers started to adopt it. So almost every teacher now uses SketchNote as part of their classes.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty amazing. And you talked a little bit about the critical thinking. I was with lunch today with a friend of mine, and we talked a little bit about comprehension and some of the tests that were done. I don't know if you know about, there's a study called Oppenheimer and Mueller, I think it is. They did a comparative study. I don't know what the amount of people that were in the study, but one group did the taking notes on a laptop, and the other did longhand notes. So it wasn't even sketching; it was just writing notes by hand from I think it was just a recorded talk. And they just found that the people that wrote by hand ended up doing lots more critical thinking and actually analyzing what was being said as they converted it into handwritten notes. And I think the big discovery they found was, people that type tend to just type verbatim because they could be close to fast enough, where people mm-hmm. who wrote couldn't, and so they had to switch into a different type of thinking. They couldn't capture everything by writing, or they got tired of it, and so they began analyzing and just writing down the key points naturally. And what they found was, after, you know, one day, the retention was pretty similar. They couldn't see a difference, but after a week, the ones who did the longhand notes had a clear advantage over the typists. And then so they ran it again, and they said, all right, we're going to tell the typists that they can't just type verbatim notes. They have to analyze, and they have to think about what they're typing. And it lasted for, I don't know, a little while, and I guess they fell right back into just keying verbatim what it was they heard, and it didn't make any difference. The test results were very similar, that the longhand note takers actually had the advantage over the long term, because they were, you know, analyzing it in their minds and making their own mental images even as they wrote just text on the page. So I found that really interesting, and I wonder, there must be some correlation between what you're talking about here in the readings and this same study.
I have absolutely no doubt about it. One of the things that I learned recently, so I have a friend of mine who works at Google and was working with the Google Books project. This was a couple of years ago. And she said that one of the problems that they were working on is people who read digital material have significantly lower retention rates than people who read on paper. Hmm. And of course, they want to digitize the world and make it available. So they were trying to figure this out. And it turns out that the way we remember is actually very much based in physical space. Because we were hunter-gatherers, we had to remember, you know, where there were dangerous animals, where there were good berries to eat, etc. So our brain naturally maps information against physical space, but there is no physical space in data, in the internet, when you have screens. So the problem is, when you're reading a book on a screen, it's just words going by. But when you read it in a physical book, you have the beginning of the book, the middle of the book, halfway through, you have the top of the page, the bottom of the page, and it doesn't seem like it's important, but that's literally how we make memories. If you think about a memory palace mm-hmm. is a hack, right, to use physical space as a way to store memories. So I actually think that that's another piece of the puzzle, is you're taking this reading, which is, you know, either digital or physical, and then you're transposing it onto a physical mm-hmm. sheet of paper, and you're creating a map of the ideas mm-hmm. so that your brain can retain it.
Yeah, that must be especially difficult, too, with digital reading, because you never know what device you might be reading it on. Maybe you're reading it on the subway home on your phone, and then you get home and flip open your iPad and read for a while, and then you might switch to your 27-inch, you know, iMac, and then you read it on a giant screen. And then so the mapping just consistently gets thrown off in that sense. So by providing this analysis space, like you're saying, like mapping it out. It's sort of a mnemonic device. I can never say mnemonic. Mnemonic device to help remember. It's kind of like a memory palace would work. It provides that anchor, I guess, is maybe the right way to say it.
Absolutely. I think that was an incredibly good insight that it's constantly moving. When I first heard about this study, I decided I would read all my fiction digitally so I could forget it and enjoy it again, and read all the nonfiction physically so I would remember it. So I actually chose my reading habits to either optimize or minimize retention.
Wow. And I have sort of had this strange sense of wanting to switch back to paper books. I don't know if it's because I just grew up with paper books and they're more natural to me, or that there's something about them. Maybe there's something going on, like you're saying, that I'm not retaining the stuff that I read digitally. And so I'm craving sort of this physical, like magazines and books. And, I sort of cross the divide between digital and analog pretty easily. I use an iPad Pro and a pencil. I also use paper and pen, and I don't have a problem using either one. And I feel like they expand my capabilities. I don't see them as one replacing the other. But that's an interesting insight about the nature of analog and why it has a place that maybe as sketchnoters we need to be aware of.
Oh, I absolutely think so. It's not whether one's better or worse, but when do you want what kind of results? For me, that's always the question, is what's the most appropriate for the end goal? I will say I can't overemphasize the importance of bad drawings, though.
Mm-hmm.
What my student had said, which was, when we realized I have this ridiculous system. So we grade on a 100-point scale, right? Like many people do, where an A is, 90 to 100, and a B is 80 to 90. And I invented something I called the 90-point scale, which was for students who sketchnoted, the worst grade they could get was a 90.
Hmm.
And the freedom from not having to make something pretty just meant that they would just draw absolutely everything. One student was reading a book about pricing, and I think he made like 10 pages of sketch notes.
Wow.
Because he just went crazy. And he got so excited about the material that he just wanted to capture everything.
Hmm.
And I think sometimes people like you or Evilotta Lamb, they're so good, and it can be kind of menacing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we need the freedom to make bad drawings because it makes us think better. And other times we want to make beautiful drawings because it ups our game. But again, that's appropriateness again, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a challenge when I did both of the books. And you'll see, if you kind of compare the first handbook to the workbook, some of the comments we got about the handbook were that everything is so beautiful, I don't feel like I can achieve it. And we did have efforts to try and, break that down. But a lot of times the message that the images are saying say certain things. And there were certainly collections of people in that book who were not professional artists and were regular people. But we heard that feedback. And so in the workbook, you may notice there's a lot more regular, not great drawings intentionally. So to open it up to even more people to take a chance at it. And even all the workshops or the talks that I do, one of my first questions is, who here feels like they don't know how to draw? And then I sort of take it from there and encourage them that by the end of this, you'll feel a lot more confident about your capabilities, because we'll walk through simple ways that we can improve them in the next hour. So I think that's a really great point, that we should allow for this rough drawing stage. And, maybe it doesn't get that much better, but I think the quality of what comes out is in some ways related to the confidence of the person and how they react to it and what it means to them, right? That's ultimately what it's about. It's whether or not it looks great. Who cares? Does it help you? That's my question always for people that start sketching. Does it work for you? Is it helping you?
And the answer is always yes. I'm going to argue that the worst drawings always have benefits, and better drawings become even more beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
But I think giving people permission to know that their bad drawings are helping, that they're helping them make sense, that they're helping them remember. I wish, here's the thing. When people walk into a room and there's a piano, nobody expects you to be able to sit down and play Chopin, right? Without doing tons and tons of scales. And yet people seem to think that drawing is like this inborn ability.
Yep.
And that if you can't draw, somehow you weren't blessed with the talent. And they don't respect the fact that, you have to draw a lot of lines and a lot of circles and just keep practicing, and everything's available to you with time.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a key thing. And it's maybe my next thing will be related to somehow providing this pathway to people who don't know where to start, that it goes even more in a simple way, and it encourages practice. So, but we'll see. I've got some things bouncing in my head around that. And I think you've just reminded me how important that is to.
I really love your books because they showed so many different styles. And that's the freedom of seeing other people's work is starting to realize there's such a huge range and that there's not a right way to draw a person. There's not a right way to draw a house. I mean, Matthias is such a great example. I always draw his kinds of people when I teach students how to draw. It's like, this guy's drawing a box with a triangle on top of it. Yet, you know, it's a person, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. That's wonderful. And this leads me to the other topic I wanted to talk about, and it was sort of a discussion that got going on Twitter, where you'd wrote an article, I think it was on both your blog and Medium, about language and visual language. Maybe I'll just leave it to you to sort of introduce the topic and what was talked about, and we'll include show note here. So if you're kind of curious about following the thread of the discussion, why don't you tell us how this started and sort of where it went to and how a variety of people got involved in the discussion?
Oh, absolutely. Well, when I was growing up as a kid, my parents would always let me buy as many books as I want, and I'm afraid I'm like that as a grown-up. So while I was working on this book on how to draw, I think I've bought like 80 to 100 books. I was just counting them on my bookcase before you called, and I was like, well, I've counted 80, and I know there's a bunch in the living room, so now I'm a little scared. But I kept seeing this trope that came up over and over again, which was the visual alphabet. So Dave Gray had said, these shapes are the visual alphabet. And if you can make these shapes, you can make anything. And you have a little bit of that, the five shapes that are the base of things. And Dan Rome has, you know, if you can draw these, you can be a visual thinker. And Ed Emberley, who's my hero, I think he's a lot of people's heroes, would be like, if you can draw these, you could make a world. And it kind of bugged me in a way because I would look at these shapes and feel like I still can't make anything. And I was really puzzling on, is this really a visual alphabet? And so I'm watching this documentary about the Mayans, and the Mayans had had language, you know, for thousands of years, and a written language. And then the Spanish came over and they burned all their books because they thought they were the devil's, you know, writings, what have you. It was a difficult time with the Inquisition and so on. And they lost the Mayan language. And so then they found these carvings on the pyramids and on stela, which are big stone tablets. And that people were trying to interpret it, but they didn't have enough material. And they could not figure out what was going on with the Mayan language. Because an alphabet usually has a certain number of characters. Like we have 26. It has a very small amount of characters. And then there's another kind of written language called syllography, at which point you write down syllables. So sh would be written differently than cha, right?
Okay.
And then the next biggest size is a logography. And a logography has two different things. It has pictures of ideas and pictures of words. So very much like your wonderful podcast where you talk about, you know, how can you draw strength or how do you draw struggle? So they'll have symbols for that. A good example is in China, you know, they'll have a symbol for house and sometimes it stands for home as well, or they'll have two different symbols. And the Mayan language didn't fit into any of these. It was too big. It had too many characters. And eventually, it was actually a art teacher turned archaeologist who was traveling in the forests, and she was looking at these, and she figured out that it was artistic license, that the Mayans would draw the same word different ways to convey emotion and meaning, as opposed to it being hyper-standardized. Think about wildly different fonts, maybe. And I had this realization suddenly that's what we do when we sketchnote. That's what we do when we draw our ideas, is we take this concept like a person, and, you know, Dan Rome draws it as stick people with hair and feet, or, you know, Matthias will draw it with a box and a triangle on it. And I thought, it's not about having a visual alphabet where these lines stand for a sound, but it's really much more like a logography. It's a hard word to say, like mnemonic. And so for us to communicate visually, what we have to do is kind of find our own language. It's almost like a language we have to invent. We have to decide, how can I comfortably draw a person? How can I comfortably draw home? How can I comfortably draw what have you? And because of the way the human brain works, we're really good at interpreting images. Have you heard of pareidolia?
No, I haven't.
I love that. It's my new favorite word. It's when you see faces everywhere. Like you look at the front of a VW bug and you go, oh, that car is smiling at me. So apparently human beings are really good at turning random imagery into faces, into people. So because of this idea of we have to find our own way to communicate, and because humans are really good at figuring out what you're trying to draw, when we sketchnote, when we draw, we really are creating an entire language. And I don't know if that feels overwhelming or wonderful. For me, it always feels really wonderful. Anyway, some people got kind of annoyed. They're like, no, there is a visual alphabet. But I think that the smallest unit of an alphabet is the one that carries meaning. So for you to communicate, you just have to draw whatever thing will convey meaning, and you're successful.
Interesting. In some ways, it made me think of, while you were describing sort of this this language, the Mayan language, almost in a sense like music. So, and I mean, music does have an alphabet, right? It's the musical scale or the notes that you can write. I mean, that's one way of writing it, but you can see the same notes and two different people can play it differently. Like if a blues guy plays it, it will sound different than, you know, a pop singer or a classical, you know, an operatic singer, right? You could use the same notes and still make it sound. So in some ways, that gets closer to why, would that be closer to what you're sort of suggesting, this interpretation in a sense? Is that the right way to think of it?
I think it's very much the right way to think of it. I always remember being, I don't know, a teenager, and I was going to an art museum in Iowa, and I heard this jazz song, and I was like, wow, this is such a great song. And then I realized, wait a second, this is the Andy Griffith theme. And I started laughing. So yeah, you know, or the way a trumpet sounds versus the way a violin sounds, you still hear the notes, but they sound so different. And I kind of love a language that has a person inside it that feels so much more human to me. And I think that's why I love looking at sketchnotes. I can look at sketchnotes for hours. When people put them on the on Twitter, I'll just flip through. I'll just do a search on the term sketchnote and flip through them, because every drawing is a person. It's not just the talk. It's the person who drew it, and they're inside the lines. And I don't know. I just dig that.
Yeah, I do too. I think even if it's someone who's taking the ideas, let's say Dave Gray's way of drawing people. I know there's a variety of people that use that way, and I'll see it being used. But I see it sort of being bent and extended, and you know, almost like the way you can, in a trombone, you can stretch a note by, you know, pulling out the slide a little bit longer, and you know, you can do different things to make that sound different. It's like the Dave Gray person is there, but it's being extended and modified and tweaked in a way that maybe Dave himself couldn't even have imagined, right, in drawing that person. So that's the thing that I love, is to see how each person's interpretation expresses itself in their sketchnote. And that can be their style of drawing or their placement of things, or especially their handwriting, and how those all interplay with each other. I find that really fascinating and fun to observe and sort of deconstruct when I see it. So I share that with you for sure.
Oh, you could even argue that a Dave Gray person is actually an Emberley person.
Sure.
Except Dave Gray puts so much Dave Gray into it, it becomes a Dave Gray person.
Right.
And then when Sonny Brown draws it, suddenly it's a Sonny Brown person, right? So I feel like a lot of our practice is finding our own voice, just like writing or music. You have to go on this journey to figure out, how do I say the word person? How do I say the word house?
Yep. And that's a lot of what I do when I do my little workshops, is just encourage people to build that for themselves. They follow along with me, and in the process of following, hopefully they start finding this little bit of voice of their own, and then hopefully we'll follow it. We do exercises at the end that they express themselves, and I'm always surprised, even the most rudimentary artist, you know, if you're looking at it from an artistic perspective, a lot of times the art itself isn't great, exactly what you were noticing with your students. But the excitement of those people that are willing to come up and talk about, let's say we do the treehouse exercise where they draw this crazy treehouse in a time box, they get really excited about it. And so often the crowd of people that are there just start laughing. It's like a comedy show, because the person has had fun drawing it, and it's something silly. Because when we do the exercise, I say, you know, the laws of gravity and the universe don't apply. You can do whatever you like. You're, you know, you got the freedom to kind of play with it. And a lot of people take me up on it and you come up with these crazy tree houses and, you know, everybody has a blast. And it's just fun to see that even the most rudimentary artwork that someone produces still can, they can still talk their way through it and talk easily. If I let them go, they'd probably talk longer than the few minutes I give them. So it's kind of amazing how much you can draw from an image that they create and how excited that they are about it. So that's really great.
You know what, though? It also reminds me of another thing that is weird about drawing, which you don't see in music, which is, why don't we copy more? Like, I went to art school, and I studied painting and drawing, and we would go to the museum, and we would copy things all the time, right? That's just part of your practice, is you copy everybody else, and then you sort of trust that eventually your style will show up. And I was just reading this really fascinating article that says that most countries, kids give up drawing when they're like 11, 12, 13, except Japan. And there's like 5 different studies that show that the reason kids stay with drawing and then get better is because they copy manga.
Really?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So because they spend a lot of time and it's socially acceptable to copy the comic books around that age, they actually get over the hump of sucking and they get good. And then they stay drawing all the way into their older years. And I think that our own prejudice against copying, like in America, causes a lot of kids to give up because, I mean, what kid is original and brilliant at 12? You know, that's not right. Exactly something we should expect.
Right. That's a really interesting observation. And again, something that could be easily built into a structured practice for someone to actually be encouraged to copy things without a stigma, in the same way that you encourage your students to, you know, to sketchnote the readings without a stigma, right? You wouldn't be graded on them. That could be really interesting to test out and see what impact that has on those who maybe have gotten stuck. Will that free them up to continue where they left off? That'd be interesting to see.
Absolutely. When I first started trying to do this kind of drawing, so I have a formal background in painting, and I could do life drawings, but I could never do the kind of drawings that you could do. And I couldn't figure it out. Like, why can't I make these kinds of drawings? And I realized I was taught to observe, but not to observe my own thoughts. And so I spent a ton of time copying cartoonists. They ended up being the ones that I learned the most from. So Ivan Brunetti's cartooning, Mort Walker's cartooning, and I would just copy. I'd fill pages full of copied New Yorker covers, everything I could find. And eventually, through making all these copies, I started to develop my own language. But I think that I couldn't have done it any other way. It really is about building a vocabulary and being comfortable with copying because of my education allowed me to do it. But if I thought I had to be original, oh my God, how exhausting would that be?
Right. And, you know, to be original is maybe to do some slight variation on something that you're copying, right? It may not be much of a degree of difference to make it a little bit original. So that's really interesting.
I think originality shows up if you just keep at it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's sort of your voice comes out naturally over time.
Yep.
Cool. Well, those are fantastic stories. And I think they're very encouraging for me, and I imagine for others who are listening. And I also love to include the practical, being a Midwesterner, you got to pull in the practical stuff. And so at this point, I would love to hear what kind of tools you like to use. What are your favorite tools? Do you use analog and digital? Are you only analog? Are there any favorite pens or books or paper that you like to use, either by yourself on your own stuff or with your students?
So I started drawing on the iPad using paper, and then I went more analog. And recently I tried to open paper again and I couldn't use it. Like, I couldn't even figure out how to open a new page. I used to love it because it was like, you know, traveling in the countryside and taking out a piece of paper and just drawing. But I feel like, I don't know if they had pressure to add a lot of features, but it's too advanced for me now. I've kind of moved over to Autodesk's Sketch. It's a little simpler and a little easier for me to handle. But mostly I really like paper for all the reasons I mentioned before, because I think it helps my memory. I think it helps me think more clearly. I like the sound a pen makes on paper. Yeah. I like the squishy sound. I'm kind of into it. So I always have a notebook on me. I went through a lot of pens. I started out, it's funny because this book took so long that I actually got better at drawing and changed tools about three times. It's a little embarrassing. I started out with a Sharpie on a great big index card, the biggest size. What is that, 5x7?
That could be 4x6, 5x7, I think one of those.
Yeah. So I started out with those, but then I started realizing I would do a lot better if I had a grid. I started using Mujis, and I immediately had to give up the Sharpie because Sharpies bleed through everything.
Yep.
And so I moved over to Micron, which I really love. The Graphic One is thick like a Sharpie, so it keeps you from getting fussy. And then I discovered if I fly with a Micron, they explode. It is the worst.
Oh, no.
They are fine if you don't get on a plane, but if you get on a plane with a Micron, the next time you take off the lid, you will be covered with ink.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so I still love them, but they're not allowed to fly with me. I like Copic a lot, but my new favorite is one that came from this podcast, which is Tombow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I went to the local art store, and I was looking to do the cool gray thing that you guys all seem to know, you know, where you add a little gray line.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they all bled through my paper until I tried Tombow. And Tombow is beautiful. So you have I have the dual-sided, the brush on one side and the point on the other. Mm-hmm. And it's so delicious. It's actually kind of lured me back into using brush again. And brush is hard to manage, but I love that variable line. It's just, it's kind of sexy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I'm so unqualified to use it, but I force myself to do it in SketchNotes. I've got some of these felt tip brush pens and sort of force myself to use them, and they're at the same time frustrating and fun, and I think the only way to get better at it is to sort of force myself to use it and see what happens. So I agree, I think they're fun to use.
I'm super into Linda Barry. I don't know if you've read her book Syllabus.
Yep,
so
I got that.
I love Linda Barry, and I love Ivan Brunetti, and I was like, I'm just gonna suck it up. And brush pen's sort of a way to eventually, I think I'm going to try to eventually get brave enough to actually use brush with ink. But the brush pen's sort of like a nice middle. And then you don't have to carry ink with you, because I like to draw on the train or when I'm traveling around. But I will tell you, there's a notebook I don't think you guys have talked about.
Okay, good.
It's
good.
Super my favorite notebook. It's called Handmade. There's like a little dot between hand and made. And the paper is like toothy and thick, and it's so good. I can't believe I'm talking about paper this way, but this paper is so delicious. It's just awesome to draw on, and I think almost nothing can bleed through it. Maybe a big fat thick Sharpie, like double thick ones, but it's amazing paper.
Wow.
And they're really lovely books. You can get them on Amazon. Or in your local art store. The art store that is near me is moving, and they're having a 25% off sale, and I don't even want to tell you. Yeah. I bought every size they had.
You
just
cleaned them out.
Oh, between the Tombows and the Handmaids, you couldn't stop me.
Wow. I've not heard of that brand. I'm kind of curious to see, because that's even a challenge with the Moleskine sketchbooks. They, you know, Sharpies bleed through, seems like everything, and I just sort of accept that fact. And I did find, by the way, that the Neuland, I got a set of gray Neuland markers, and they lay really well on the sketchbook paper, where many of the others will bleed through immediately. Eventually, I mean, if you keep soaking them, they'll bleed through, but they do really well laying on the surface, especially compared to like a Copic or a Sharpie.
That's nice. I don't like the Moleskine, because a sketchbook, which reduces the bleeding, is too glossy for me.
Mm-hmm.
It lost the toothiness, and I was unhappy. I actually almost stopped drawing, and then I thought, I don't have to fill this notebook. I'm going to set it aside and buy a new notebook. And it was really weird. I couldn't believe that the paper actually made me not want to draw anymore.
Mm.
It's funny, because I use these really cheap Mujis. If I don't want to, I'm worried I'm going to lose it, like I'm going to be on the bus or something, I'll just grab one of the little Mujis and stick it in my back pocket. Mm. And they're not the best, but they're definitely not the worst, and they're so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty much balancing between my Handmade, which is when I feel artistic and fussy, and my Muji when I'm disposable and I want to draw like the same thing 15 times to figure out how to draw. You know, that's something you guys don't talk about a lot either, is drawing with pen and drawing with pencil is so different.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I guess maybe a little bit, but when you draw with pencil, you can make mistakes. When you draw with a pen, you're going to draw the same drawing 10 times in order to try to figure it out. I got to visit Dan Rome for the first time. I know I'm like, Dan Rome, squee! I'm kind of a fangirl. But on his office back wall, he had these funny little drawings that he puts on Twitter. They're like jokes. But he would do the drawing, and then over in the corner, you could see, like, he'd draw the hand 5 times. And I suddenly realized that's what I do, is you make the main drawing, and then if there's one part you don't like, you do some versions, and then you clean it up in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. But it's a very different process than trying to find the true drawing with a pencil versus drawing the same thing and saying, is it better this way or better this way?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really approached very much drawing with a pencil. I do it all the time. In fact, when I do illustration work, like my book illustration work, I use pencil all the time to figure out what I'm going to do. And I think that's super important. That could be a little course in itself, right? How to use a pencil and how to be free with it. And I think that's maybe something that can be explored. I think for me, so the challenge for me and the reason why I stayed away from pencil and sketchnoting, at least initially, was I used pencil because I was worried about making mistakes, and the pencil was there so I could erase it and fix it. When I do illustration work, of course, I draw it multiple times to get it right. But when I do sketch notes, I've been moving to this space where, I don't know, if I have mistakes in there, I just leave them in there. I think in some ways it makes it a lot more realistic and more approachable, right? If someone's looking at my sketch notes and they see some screw-ups from me, and I've been doing this 10 years, that feels like a lot more honest way to go about it, and probably more encouraging to someone who sees it than to make it perfect. And then, you know, maybe it actually turns someone away from doing sketchnoting because they feel like they can never approach that. I think that's sort of where my mind space is these days. But definitely the pencil is a different animal altogether. And that's an interesting observation that maybe that could be a new teaching space.
And I think with those mistakes, you get the wabi-sabi, you know, the Japanese term for the imperfection that makes it more beautiful and more human.
Yep.
And I think there's something also very nice about that, is to see the line where you go a little bit too far, and you, like architects sometimes, you know, they'll go a little bit past. Mm-hmm. And it feels very appealing to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like you sort of get in, you sort of on the inside of the person's work, like you actually see sort of, it's sort of like seeing the math homework, right? Like you could do a perfect, you know, algebraic expression, but to see them working through it and making mistakes, that's what the teacher wants to see, to make sure you're actually thinking through it and not just copying somebody else, right? And you know, not the negative side of copying to pass a test, not the copying to get better at something. So that's really fascinating. Any other tools? Have you come back to, sounds like you've come back to the iPad with Sketchbook. There's another tool that I've heard about, and it's a $10 app by, I think, the guys who run the Icon Factory, I believe, called Linea. And it's a simple sketching application. It's pretty simple. It's got a few basic colors and a few pens, and it's sort of like what Paper was. It's a version one. It's just been released a few weeks ago. I haven't splurged to buy it just because I've been really busy, but I've heard some good reports about that application because it is somewhat limited and simple. It's not really designed to be a drawing program. It's a sketching application, which I think is subtle, but I think important distinction, because a lot of people use drawing applications to do sketch notes because it gives them variety. And the reason I like Paper by 53, even the new incarnation, and I think the frustration, my guess is that it has been iterated enough that if you went away from it for a while, it could seem like you just landed in Romania, right? And you speak Italian, right? So I think the one thing I do like about it is, even with the advanced features, they do put limits on everything, and it sort of forces me into a little bit more like using a paper and a pen in some senses, more than some of the other applications, which seem a lot more limitless.
Yeah, I think we live in a funny time where we could have 5 different drawing apps or 5 different writing apps. So with writing apps, you think about something like IA Writer, where it has no functionality, and you buy it because all you can do is type, and you're kind of like Jack Kerouac, just typing with a regular typewriter. And I think there's something attractive about getting away. You know, Procreate is amazing, amazing tool. I actually like Brushes a lot. Brushes is probably my favorite tool on the iPad of everything. But there's something nice about just picking up a pencil and drawing. I will say I don't really like the way it feels, you know, the glass. I miss the toothiness of paper. Mm-hmm. Although I just got the latest Surface Pro and the pen, and I think I might start drawing digitally again.
Mm, interesting.
It sounds weird to go to Microsoft, but I will tell you the Surface is a terrific, terrific drawing surface. I guess that's why they called it. But I was just shocked at how nice it was to draw. It reminded me of the first time I opened paper, and I liked it. And then I eventually kind of slid away. But the pencil gives you a lot of, gives you pressure, gives you a lot of precision. It's, if you have a Microsoft store and you can go visit it, check it out. It's pretty good.
Well, and I guess Microsoft's, I think this is like the fifth revision, right? So they've had five chances to kind of keep tuning and toning and making it right, right? So we're, you know, the iPad, they've had a variety, but they've never made drawing in this way focus until now. So that's interesting. I know one of my solutions for the iPad Pro that I have is I bought, I found some matte screen covers on Amazon, and I've applied those. And that adds just enough tooth to make it feel a little bit more like, it's sort of like really silky paper. I wouldn't call it toothy, but it adds a little bit of drag and a little bit of silkiness. I don't know how else to describe that to the pencil tip that makes it feel a little bit more like a paper experience. And I think it's like $8 for two, and they last a long time. So that might be something to explore if you want to try and reclaim your iPad. Maybe stick some matte screen covers on there and see if that impacts how you feel about it.
Oh, definitely. I think the word drag is right. Yes. I think what we're looking for is, it sounds funny, but we're looking for a way to slow down. Because when you slow down, you can think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. Well, we're at the point now where I ask you to share three tips with the listeners. It can be conceptual, it can be mindset, it can be even as simple as the best way to sharpen your pencils or something like that. So with that said, I'll leave it open to you to give us three tips that you think will be helpful.
Well, I think I've talked about them a little bit, but I want to reiterate the importance of making bad drawings. I cannot believe that even a dreadful drawing communicates better than words most of the time. So today I was asked if I would guest lecture about story at Carnegie Mellon at the EA campus. And I went there and I drew like the worst dragon. I was talking about stories. The students came up with a dragon. I realized I didn't have any idea how to draw a dragon. I think I drew the Loch Ness monster breathing flame. I mean, just really bad. And they loved it. They were fascinated. They were laughing. They were having a good time. And it encouraged them to want to draw. And I think sometimes we feel a little bit like we're supposed to show off. We're supposed to make this gorgeous thing that everybody's going to retweet on Twitter. But bad drawings, you know, they do the job, they're funny, they're charming, they have personality. I think I wish I could encourage people, you know, to start making drawings and not worry about them being good, but just make as many drawings as you can. Quantity leads to quality. So I think one of the things I do with my students is I ask them to fill up every inch of a page with lines. And then I ask them to fill up every inch of a page with squares and fill up every inch of a page with circles. And making lots and lots and lots of things starts to tell you about what it takes to make good things and when it's kind of okay to make a sloppy circle or kind of a charming, funky triangle. So I think making lots of bad drawings is actually really important for us.
Good.
Another one I want to give is about sketchnoting books. And chapters. Mm-hmm. So it feels kind of overwhelming. You know, when you're doing a talk, it's fast, but at least it's kind of short. So if you're reading an entire, like the Lean Startup, my students basically sketchnote the entire book in my Creative Founder class. And that's a big book. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is to not draw everything the way you do with a talk, but really, really look. I guess in talks, you don't draw everything, right? You just listen for the really big ideas. Mm-hmm. That would kill you. So you got to listen for the really big ideas and then not worry, but just let your brain look for whatever pops in your head, you know, whatever image. And even if it doesn't make sense to anybody else, just draw that image. I find that when I'm reading a book, I won't draw for a couple of pages because they're telling stories or they're going on and then I'll end up drawing like the eight stages of play. Right now I'm reading Stuart Brown's play, and I'm sketching out sections of it. And I think it's more sketchnoting for yourself. You just want to note the stuff that really matters to you, that you want to write it into your brain. I guess that's how I think of it, is I'm writing the book into my brain. So I'm picking the stuff I want to keep forever. So don't worry about being comprehensive. Don't worry what the author would think, but just write the things that you want to keep for yourself. And I feel like that's a really important thing for sketchnoting. And I think the last one, gosh, I had two. I think if I was going to say one more, it's copy everything you like. Not just because it makes you a better drawer, because it's wonderful. Like, when you really love something, drawing it is awesome. You could draw your wife, you can draw your cat, you can draw a New Yorker cover, you can draw a Willy Wonka illustration. Like, just anytime you love something, draw it. Just for the sheer joy of making the lines that are lines that represent something you love. I think sometimes we forget that drawing is wonderful. It's magical. It's delicious. It's an end to itself. That putting lines down onto paper is something our ancestors have been doing since the days of the caves. And it's our birthright. We have the right to make lines, and nobody can tell you that your lines are bad or good. So I think, draw lines that make you happy.
That's wonderful. I think those are three great tips, and I can't wait for this episode to come out so we can share the wisdom that you're providing and the stories that you're telling. And again, another great episode of the podcast that I'm excited to share with everybody who loves the podcast and those who are going to stumble onto it eventually. And oddly enough, this crazy idea that we can talk about drawing and somehow it's interesting is kind of crazy.
Architecture.
Yes. So I think that it just speaks to this desire to kind of come back to drawing as just a joyful thing to do. And thank you so much for making time, Christina, and sharing all these stories and this wisdom with us tonight. It's been wonderful.
I'm so honored that you asked me. Thank you so much.
Well, you are welcome. I'm excited to expose you to hopefully lots more new people. And I think that makes a great point for me to wrap up the show and call this another one in the can for the Sketchnote Army podcast in season 3. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And until the next episode of the podcast, we'll talk to you later.